Our first presenter today is Dr. Melinda Wharton. Dr. Wharton is the Deputy Director of the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Wharton?
Thanks, Nancy. I'm delighted to have a chance to speak as part of the first National Immunization Conference online. In this presentation, I'm going to talk about the beginning of the 317 program 50 years ago, where we are now, and what we expect in the future. The first direct federal funding for immunization in the United States was in the 1950s, when Congress appropriated funding to help state and local communities purchase and administer the new inactivated polio vaccine. A few years later, oral polio vaccines were licensed in the United States, and public health officials proposed a new immunization initiative that they hoped would build on the enthusiasm that existed for these new vaccines. In February 1962, President Kennedy asked Congress to fund a wide-ranging health program. He said, "There's no longer any reason why American children should suffer from polio, diphtheria, whooping cough, or tetanus, diseases which can cause death or serious consequences throughout a lifetime, which can be prevented, but which will prevail in too many cases." The Vaccine Assistance Act was approved by the House of Representatives in June 1962 and by the Senate in early October. President Kennedy signed it into law on October 23, 1962, which of course is 50 years ago this year, and also happened to have been in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis. The law authorized the appropriation of $14 million in the first year and $11 million in each of the next 2 years to make grants to states to support immunization programs to protect their populations, especially preschool children, from polio, diphtheria, whooping cough, and tetanus. Funds were first appropriated in 1963, and in that year, CDC made 61 grants for vaccine assistance, including both vaccine and some personnel to help with program coordination, but not direct delivery of immunization services. It wasn't until 1992 that funds were provided for actual provision of immunization services. The Vaccines for Children program, or VFC, is going to be discussed more in the next presentation, but I'll just have a few comments about it in this one. It was created by the 1993 Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act and became operational in 1994. The VFC program provides federally purchased vaccine at no cost to the family for the vaccine to eligible children when seen by an immunization provider who participates in the VFC program. Eligible children through 18 years of age are those who are eligible for Medicaid, who are uninsured, or who are American Indian or Alaska Native. Additionally, underinsured children, those with insurance that doesn't cover the full cost of vaccines, are eligible for the VFC program when seen at a federally qualified health center or rural health center. The law that created the VFC program gives CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices the authority to determine the vaccines that are included in the VFC program. VFC is an entitlement program, so as the number of children who are eligible increases, or the number of the vaccines included in the program increases, the funding for the program also increases. VFC has been unbelievably important for providing access to vaccines for children in the United States. However, there's relatively little support from the VFC program for the people and infrastructure that are needed to run immunization programs. Most of the federal support for immunization infrastructure comes from the 317 program. So 317 is really critical for implementation of the much larger VFC program. Now, thanks to the many immunization providers, public health officials, community coalitions, and others, including families, we've achieved and sustained high immunization coverage among children. This slide shows our vaccine coverage data for children at 19 to 35 months of age over the last couple of decades. We've maintained high coverage for older vaccines and see rapid increases in coverage for newer vaccines as they've been added to the schedule. In other sessions at this National Immunization Conference online, we've seen the excellent control we've achieved for almost all of these diseases. we have excellent control for almost all the diseases. Not all of them have been presented at the conference. We've also been doing well in terms of coverage with some of the new adolescent vaccines. We've seen consistent increases in coverage for both Tdap and meningococcal conjugate vaccines, but we are concerned about how we're doing with HPV vaccine coverage in girls, where we haven't been seeing the same kinds of increases in coverage as we have with Tdap and the meningococcal conjugate vaccine. This has been discussed in other sessions in the online conference and is clearly an area where we can all do better. There's also room for improvement in adult immunization. Now, I have to acknowledge that our adult schedule is more complicated than the childhood schedule, with some vaccines specifically recommended for persons with certain underlying conditions or in groups at high risk of exposure, and other vaccines are recommended for everyone in a certain age group. So making the whole thing work is more complicated. But we clearly can do better across the board in adult immunization. For example, only 14% of adults 60 years of age and older have gotten the herpes zoster vaccine, and only two-thirds of adults 65 years of age and older got a flu shot during the 2010-2011 season. Although influenza vaccine coverage among healthcare workers has improved, there's still room to do better. Of course, the reason we try to achieve high coverage is to prevent disease, and sometimes that protection extends beyond the individual. Here's an example. We began using the 7-valent pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, or PCV7, in young children in the United States in 2000. There were dramatic reductions in invasive pneumococcal disease due to serotypes included in the vaccine, not only in the children who were vaccinated, but in other age groups as well. This slide shows that after we started vaccinating children with PCV7, that the types covered by the vaccine almost disappeared as causes of invasive pneumococcal disease in people 65 years of age and older who didn't get this vaccine but were protected indirectly. We're now starting to see impacts of use of the new 13-valent pneumococcal conjugate vaccine in children. Some early data were presented in another session in this conference, and it will be very interesting to see what happens with continued use of that vaccine. Now, the VOC program has been very successful, but there still was the problem of the underinsured. These are the children who have insurance, but the insurance doesn't cover all the costs of vaccination. Some insurance plans don't cover all ACIP-recommended vaccines or other required copays or deductibles. Although many families can and do pay these costs, for some they are a financial burden and present an economic barrier to vaccination. And although underinsured children are eligible to receive VFC vaccine at federally qualified health centers and rural health centers, these facilities aren't in every community and are not always able and available to provide this safety net function. In 2010, Congress passed the Affordable Care Act. Although there are continue to be some uncertainties about the law, under the Affordable Care Act, new health insurance plans are required to provide coverage for ACIP-recommended vaccines without deductibles or copays when delivered by an in-network provider. As new plans are written and existing plans lose their grandfathered status, the number of underinsured children and adults should be starting to decrease. With full implementation over the next several years, the expectation is that the problem of the underinsured should largely be solved. But even as private sector coverage for vaccines improves, our 317-funded immunization infrastructure will continue to be very important. These funds provide critical support for the people and systems that make immunization programs work. There's the immunization program personnel who recruit immunization providers. There's the very important quality assurance and provider education activities. There's surveillance and outbreak response, immunization information systems, assessment of immunization coverage, vaccine safety, all the things that really are needed for an effective immunization program. And this is really the foundation that the VFC program will continue to rely on. So we're going to take a look in a little more detail at just a couple of these functions by way of providing examples. Vaccine storage and handling is a really critical function of an immunization program. Immunization providers must have reliable and appropriate refrigerators and freezers for vaccine storage and reliable and appropriate temperature monitoring equipment that's been appropriately calibrated and is being appropriately used. They must have knowledgeable staff. They must have written storage and handling plans that cover both routine and exceptional circumstances. And of course, they have to make sure that those storage and handling plans are followed. And this is all to keep, you know, assure that vaccine supplies are appropriately stored and handled to maintain safety and effectiveness. Here's another example. In other talks on this online conference, we've heard about some of the outbreak response activities that state and local public health agencies have undertaken in recent years. Whether it's pertussis in a high school or measles in a hospital, when outbreaks occur, there are response activities that public health undertakes. These are broad and very time-consuming and very complex. There's identifying potential cases, figuring out where the disease was acquired and where it might further spread, whether the persons with disease were vaccinated or not. So is it vaccine failure or failure to vaccinate that's actually causing the outbreak? There's control measures that need to be implemented, which, depending on the circumstances, might include isolation and quarantine, vaccination, or providing antimicrobial prophylaxis to persons who've been exposed. These are incredibly labor-intensive efforts, and most of them are undertaken by state and local public health department staff. And of course, our laboratories provide critical support for outbreak response. Now, I started this talk looking back at how the 317 program started 50 years ago. But what will the future look like? We expect there will continue to be shared responsibility between public and private sectors. For the insured, insurance should assure access to ACIP-recommended vaccines for both children and adults. VFC will continue to provide vaccines for eligible children, and we hope that the 317 vaccine funding can help fill some of the remaining gaps with support for vaccination of uninsured adults, helping us maintain or improve our response to outbreaks, and helping support preparedness. This is also a time with lots of exciting opportunities for modernizing our immunization programs. There are all the information technology initiatives for meaningful use and interoperability to barcoding and VTRAX. There's exciting possibilities to use immunization information systems, electronic health records, and other technology like text messaging to improve coverage. And there are the billing initiatives that programs are planning and implementing, so private insurance will pay for fully insured persons who are vaccinated in public health clinics. Now we should be able to do more for vaccination of adults. As insurance provides better coverage for adults, we should be able to make progress in a wide range of settings to improve adult immunization. We need to think broadly and look for partners and collaborators in both medical and non-medical settings. Different strategies and resources will be needed to reach patients in different settings. Adult immunization is not a childhood immunization, but older. We think it will look very different from our childhood program, and we're excited about the possibilities that we now see going forward. So, as always, it's a very exciting time in immunization. I actually can't think of a time in immunization that hasn't been exciting. But we're well positioned to take advantage of these many new opportunities. This last slide shows where we want to end up: protecting our communities from vaccine-preventable diseases, maintaining or even improving our capacity to respond to public health threats, and protecting the most vulnerable in our communities. And as we all work together, I'm confident we can get there. Thank you.